Good morning. I'd like to talk about Britain, the negatives and positives in connection with the theme of this session. The main threats to Western Judeo-Christian civilization in my country are roughly as follows. Family breakdown, rampant abuse of alcohol. If you saw the cover of Time magazine a couple of weeks ago, you'll know what I'm talking about. The diffusion of conspiracy theories, irrationality, and other forms of unreality on the internet, and an almost uniquely vulgar popular culture. You may have heard of a TV reality show called Big Brother, perhaps you even have it here, which is ironically made by an old Etonian descendant of the great Victorian engineer, Bazalgette, who built London's main sewer system. So there's a certain sort of family continuity there. Then we have the BBC, which I'm sure is very popular in this room, and the left humanities departments in the universities. Both of these still subscribe to the divisive public creed of multiculturalism, despite the fact that this has been disavowed by all three major political parties in Britain, notably by the Conservative Party. I'll tell you a little local story. The BBC recently ventured into unknown territory, anxious of some of the criticisms made about it. It made or commissioned a quasi-anthropological series of programmes, not about pygmies in Papua New Guinea, but called White. Predictably, this culminated in a girl from a dysfunctional working-class background in the north of England who finds meaning, order, and structure in her life. Yes, you've already guessed it, by converting to Islam. As for the universities, our academics, some of our universities recently banned the military from our campuses, people recruiting for the military, and the National Union of Teachers tried to do the same with the schools, while of course they allow subversive Saudi-financed organisations and charities to build up what are called Islamic studies all over the shop, and while academics, in addition to trying to boycott Israel, refused to cooperate with our security services in identifying students who were exhibiting worrying signs of religious extremism. Which brings me neatly to the impact of aggressive secularists. You'll know the usual suspects, Richard Dawkins, Christopher Hitchens, all the rest of them. To the dynamic, the interaction between such people and, paradoxically, the finger-jabbing Islamists on the other hand, and how this has impacted on our churches and societies as a whole. One response, that of Rowan Williams, the Archbishop of Canterbury, has been to make common cause with the imams by suggesting that we modify our centuries-old common law to incorporate Sharia law. After all, the bankers, having devised such instruments of genius as subprime, have really got into Sharia finance as well, so why shouldn't the Church of England and our legal system follow too? This is all roughly on a par with a Dutch bishop who made it much more simple, in a sense, by suggesting that we just call God Allah. Now, such unclarities, that's what Williams, that's how he described his speech, and the unclarities, if we're going to be charitable to him, perhaps he's read too much German theology or biblical Greek, which does things to your use of language. Such unclarities provoked a very angry response. He was condemned by the leaders of all the political parties, all of the press, and many members of the public, who are fed up with the escalating demands of a tiny minority within our 1.6 million Muslim minority. These demands, to talk about them almost randomly, have resulted in certain areas of Britain, notably in the Midlands and the North, becoming effectively no-go areas, where what you would find going to Cairo and bumping into fundamentalists in Cairo is already evident. It's rather like a type of chill draft coming into a room. It just inhibits certain types of behaviour, and aspects of the local culture shut down, and the indigenous population essentially moves out. I've yet to find something so striking as what occurred in a little town to the west of London called Slough, where a lot of immigrants from Mirpur in Kashmir purchased 18 adjacent terraced houses, knocked the garden walls down in order to recreate the conditions in a Kashmiri village in a little town about 40 miles west of London. I suppose most of the response to Rowan Williams's speech was based on a diffuse sense that we are still cultural Christians, even though church attendance in Britain is increasingly something that African Pentecostalists or Polish Catholics tend to do. The problem, however, with cultural Christianity is that if it is excluded from the schools, as it seems to be, or indeed if efforts are made on a federal level in Europe to exclude it, as they did from the draft constitution, then there are problems of intergenerational transmission. And eventually, Christianity, rather like the classics, will be something like the folk customs that are dimly remembered by Winston Smith in George Orwell's novel 1984. He can sort of catch snatches in his head of songs that were once sung or practices or this and that. Now, lest I leave you in despair, there are a few signs of hope. The present conservative leadership seems to be taking culture, if not religion, more seriously than the conservative government of the 1980s. Quite naturally, the government of Margaret Thatcher, and to a lesser extent her successor, concentrated on hard issues of economics and foreign policy and of defeating communism, which of course was one of the principal achievements of that era. Issues of culture were not too important. This is changing. The BBC is very likely to find that its poll tax on the British public is going to be gradually diverted to other public service providers, while broadcasters who are obviously party pre, like Fox News, will be allowed to function. Some people, and I'm certainly one of them, would also urge that similar things should be done with our universities, perhaps, of course, by encouraging research-based think tanks through tax breaks. And coming to this meeting, it's certainly heartening to see the role that think tanks have played in a vibrant conservative culture in this country, and I think we should follow that. There's even an upside, as it were, with the Islamists and with our Muslim minority. Some of the recent successes of our security services against terrorist conspiracies, and there is a very complex trial going on at the moment against the people who wanted to blow up 8 transatlantic airliners, which is why, of course, you can't take liquids on planes, have resulted from information supplied by concerned Muslim citizens. And in fact, the security services found out about this plot because somebody was, a Muslim, was concerned about the aberrant activities of one member of that conspiracy, and then the security services put agents inside it. Another interesting development, which sort of has echoes of what I imagine your security services are trying to do in Iraq and elsewhere, which is to disaggregate the opponent. We've had former Muslim activists, notably a young man called Ed Hussein, who wrote a very interesting book called The Islamist, which describes his own radicalization to the threshold of extremism. People like him have mobilized others who've been down the same path to speak out publicly about how they came to that point in their lives and why they changed their minds, and they're recommending that others do the same. So that's a rather heartening development, I would have thought. And it suggests that these communities are not entirely opaque to us. The other thing which Bart may well talk about, there's a lot of rather ill-informed talk about the demographics of Muslim communities in Europe. And I would say that, contrary to the alarmism of some books, like While Europe Slept, Eurabia and all the rest of it, that the demographics suggest that after a generation or two, people settle down and adjust to European norms, chiefly for purely economic reasons, I suspect, that six kids is expensive. Finally, I'd like to make this point, that certainly in Britain there is now a public climate where what the Conservative leader discovered, he found the term population movements, rather than talking about immigration, which of course raises all sorts of issues, that word, we now talk about population movement. This can now be discussed honestly and without cheap charges of racism. And it means that very eminent economists organised in a society called Migration Watch, and indeed a committee of the House of Lords who reported last week or the week before, can, without being impugned, establish that the net economic benefit to us per immigrant is roughly the cost of a Mars bar per week. Now, that is something that we haven't heard discussed in public, certainly for the last 10 or 20 years. We are also, of course, much more open nowadays about describing the sort of culture that we want to live in, which is why such curiosities as the desire to have the call of the muezzin echoing around Oxford, a suburb of East Oxford, have been found to be very unacceptable to many people, chiefly, of course, because it might realise Edward Gibbon's horror joke, as it were, he wrote in The Decline and Fall, that had the Battle of Poitiers in, I think, 732 gone the other way, that Oxford itself would have people studying the Quran and the minarets would be there and so forth. But anyway, people in Oxford are now rather agitated about that. They're also agitated about the prospect of having a Saudi-financed 35,000-seat mega-mosque right adjacent to the 2012 Olympic Stadium in East London, and I suspect that won't happen either. So, after many wrong turns, some of which resulted in what French intelligence officers called Londonistan, all the personalities of which have either been deported, prevented from entering the country, or in one case are facing extradition to the United States on terrorist charges, the road ahead seems slightly clearer than it did a few years ago, although way to go, as you might say over here, among our American friends. Thank you very much.